Hello again there, folks. So we're hearing the term Caesarism being bandied around quite a bit at the moment because of political shenanigans in the real world and just in the West in general. And I thought it would be interesting to take a look at Oswald Spengler's, because it comes from Oswald Spengler's Decline and Fall of the West. And I thought it would be interesting to go through it and see what Spengler himself has to say on it. So I've pulled out my copy of Decline of the West. It's in volume two. And there's a couple of sort of caveats here. Like, I want to issue like a fair warning that you don't delve into Spengler and then expect like happy clappy fun time white pilling content. So there's a fair warning there. Spengler's known for his pessimism. But let's have a look at what a little bit of context here is that. So Spengler thinks a civilization has a definite beginning, a middle, and an end. You can compare it to the seasons or the way a plant grows. So in Western civilization, the springtime would be the Gothic cathedrals going up. Essentially, it's the Middle Ages, highly spiritual, highly productive, and artistic. And then we head into the civilization phase. Caesarism comes late, very late in the cycle. So if the Gothic cathedrals going up around Europe happened in the springtime, Caesarism comes in the winter. So we can then have a look at this and what he has to say about the current state that our civilization should be in by now, and we can kind of think about is it true, or what does it reveal about the nature of history and things like that. So let's jump in then. So Spengler says, by the term Caesarism, I mean that kind of government which, irrespective of any constitutional formulation that it may have, is in its inward self a return to thorough formlessness. It does not matter that Augustus in Rome and Huang Ti in China, Amasis in Egypt, and Alp Arslan in Baghdad disguised their position under antique forms. The spirit of these forms was dead, and so all institutions, however carefully maintained, were thenceforth destitute of all meaning and weight. Real importance centred in the wholly personal power exercised by the Caesar, or by anybody else capable of exercising it in his place, is a form-fulfilled world in primitivism, into the cosmic historyless. Biological stretches of time once more take the place vacated by historical periods. At the beginning, where the civilization is developing to full bloom, there stands the miracle of the cosmopolis, the great petrifact, a symbol of the formless, vast, splendid, spreading in insolence. It draws within itself the being streams of the now impotent countryside, human masses that are wafted as dunes from one to another, or flow like loose sand into the chinks of stone. Here, money and intellect celebrate their greatness and their last triumphs. It is the most artificial, the cleverest phenomenon manifested in the light world of human eyes. Uncanny, too good to be true, in quotes, standing already almost beyond the possibilities of cosmic foundation. Presently, however, the idea-less facts come forward again, naked and gigantic. The eternal cosmic pulse has finally overcome the intellectual tensions of a few centuries. In the form of democracy, money has won. There has been a period in which politics were almost its preserve, but as soon as it has destroyed the old orders of culture, the chaos gives forth a new and overpowering factor that penetrates to the very elementals of becoming, the Caesar men. Before them, the money collapses. The imperial age, in every culture alike, signifies the end of the politics of mind and money. The powers of the blood, unbroken, bodily forces resume their ancient lordship. Race springs forth pure and irresistible. The strongest win, and the residue is their spoil. They seize the management of the world, and the realm of books and problems petrifies or vanishes from memory. From now on, new destinies in the style of the pre-culture time are possible, afresh and visible to the consciousness, without cloaks of causality. Okay, so what Spengler's getting at then is that in the civilization period, it drifts. So in the culture phase, you'll find that it's very religious, it's very artistic, and it's interested in spiritualism, metaphysics. And in our civilization, the turning point would really be around about the Enlightenment. And then in Spengler's view, and then the civilization gives rise to materialism, and eventually, just to skip it on a little bit, what the Caesars are going to take over from the money power. So, and Spengler also uses the word intellect because he sees that as being, he kind of uses it with disdain because he doesn't have any time for the expert and the technicians, and also all of these ideologies which are coming in after the Enlightenment. Politics is that he's kind of looking at it from outside of ideology completely, and looking at it, all of these things as a historical process. So if you think of all of these ologies and isms, and capitalism, Marxism, nationalism, fascism, it goes on, neoliberalism, all of these things are competing ideologies, and they all well, pretty much, but it what one won out was money. Not, he wouldn't use so much use the word capitalism, but money. And then the intellect crafts it's these ideas and these ideologies around this materialist paradigm. And so this is eventually going to sap all of the spiritual components out of the civilization and eventually reduce it to not to a wreck, really. And the Caesar, it gets to the point where it's just unbearable for everybody. And the Caesar man, the strong man, is going to come in and put an end to it completely. So, as he says, before them, the money collapses. And what you're going to get is a return to primitivism, a return to an older way of life. But the Caesar men don't have any, they're not political. They don't have some ideological framework. It's like almost just like a will to power ethic. And they're going to come in, and then Spengler's going to move on a little bit, and he says, once the imperial age has arrived, so this is the age of the Caesars rather than colonialism of the past. That belongs in the civilization phase. Again, money is the driving force. There are no more political problems. People manage with the situation as it is and the powers that be. In the period of contending states, back in the civilization period, torrents of blood had reddened the pavements of all world cities so that the great truths of democracy might be turned into actualities, and for the winning of rights without which life seemed not much the living. So here we talk, he's kind of talking about liberalism and all of these abstract rights which are granted to you. Now these rights are won, but the grandchildren cannot be moved, even by punishment, to make use of them, which, is kind of the case today because everybody's so brainwashed that freedom of speech, what's the point? 100 years more, and even the historians will no longer understand the old controversies. Already by the Caesar's time, reputable people had almost ceased to take part in the elections. It embittered the life of the great Tiberius that the most capable men of his time held aloof from politics, and Nero could not even by threats compel the equites to come to Rome in order to exercise their rights. This is the end of the great politics, the conflict of intelligences that had served as substitute for war must give place to war itself in its most primitive form. It is therefore a complete misunderstanding of the meaning of the period to presume, as Mommsen did, a deep design of subdivision in the diarchy fashioned by Augustus with its partition of powers between princeps and senate. A century earlier, this constitution would have been a real thing, but that would in itself suffice to make it impossible for such an idea to have entered the heads of the present force men. Now it meant nothing but the attempt of a weak personality to deceive itself as to inexorable facts by mantling them in empty forms. Caesar saw things as they were and was guided in the exercise of his rulership by definite and unsentimental practical considerations. The legislation of the last months was concerned wholly with transitional provisions, none of which were intended to be permanent. This is precisely what has generally been overlooked. He was far too deep a judge of things to anticipate development or to settle its definitive forms at this moment, with the Parthian War impending. So the Caesar man is not concerned at all about ideologies or politics. Politics itself is now a dead form because nobody particularly cares anymore. They've retreated into themselves, and basically people just want to be left alone to get on their own lives. This is something which you can see today, where the money and the intellect, if you think of the intelligentsia, which is obviously a linked word, you'll see that it intrudes on the life of the individual ever more. It's a relentless intrusion and tormenting by, think of political correctness, think of the censorship on social media, all of these different things. It's money and intellect with an ideology, social justice or whatever, but there's lots of them actually, imposing itself on the individual. The Caesar man doesn't have any time for that. And what Spengler's going to go on to say in a little bit is that they'll actually consciously just burn books and wipe all of this stuff out. Another thing that the Caesar man will do is to hunt down and purge secretive guild organisations and what's left of these merchant classes behind the scenes, scheming and plotting against, mainly against himself, but just the general state of the nation, of the civilization. That has its time. And you'll see in Western civilization, in the history of it, all of these guilds and merchants and secretive groups, they did actually gain steam at the beginning of the civilizational phase. And where we are in right now in the West, they're at peak power. But according to Spengler, this isn't permanent, because people are going to rise up and put them down quite brutally, in actual fact. But it isn't all happy days, I'm afraid. And he mentions quite extensively what went on in Rome, which I don't think I need to get into, because it gets really into the idea of what happened with Marcus Aurelius and various other Caesars, and it all amounts to the same thing. It's this stripping back of the constitutions, or where the constitutions and the politics becomes just a sort of artifact of the past. And what actually matters is the will to power. And in a sort of Machiavellian mode, where you're not really hamstrung anymore by any kind of ideals or idealism or ideologies. All of this is gone now. And it's just the Caesar man imposing his will. And so Spengler's going to continue by pointing out that why the Caesar men despise ideologues or people who are idealists or have deep political convictions. So he says, what these Stoics were in Rome, the Confucians were in China. So this is another thing that Spengler does throughout both volumes of Decline of the West, is that if his thesis that there is a civilizational, if it cycles, like the seasons, let's say, then you should be able to cross-reference this with other civilizations. So, for example, what was the age of Caesarism like in China? Was there an age of Caesarism in the Chinese civilization? And there was, and he's going to point out what that was like. So what these Stoics were in Rome, the Confucians were in China, and seeing thus the episode of the burning of the books decreed by the Chinese Augustus in 212, so that there is an equivalent in China and in Egypt and in these other civilizations to Augustus Caesar or to Napoleon and so on like that. Begins to be intelligible through the reproach of immense vandalism that the minds of late illiterates fasted upon. But after all, these Stoic enthusiasts for an ideal that had become impossible had killed Caesar. The philosophers in the Senate, which by them was only a noble club, never wearied of lamenting the downfall of freedom and fomenting conspiracies such as Piso's in 65. And he's going to go on and then say, these were acts of defensive state necessity vis-a-vis blind ideology. Acts such as those we know of, Cromwell and Robespierre, and it was in exactly the same position that the Chinese Caesars found themselves vis-a-vis the school of Confucius, which had formerly worked out their ideal of a state constitution and now had no notion of enduring the actuality. So, if to use to Cromwell and Robespierre are both, they obviously had their own ideals. They were obviously very ideological. They had visions, political visions or religious visions in each case. But you'll also find that both of them, the money power and the guilds and the merchants, these schemers, were also backing both of them to undermine the civilization. So these things aren't outside of the flow of history. They just manifest themselves through different actors on the historical stage. Cromwell and Robespierre being two good examples in actual fact. This great burning of the books, and so these are the exact kind of people who the Caesar men deem untrustworthy, not just because their philosophies and ideals subvert the nation, but because behind them there's always these scheming guilds and secretive organizations. All of this stuff is what the Caesar men are just going to wipe out. So, and it was in exactly the same position that the Chinese Caesars had found themselves vis-a-vis the school of Confucius, which had formerly worked out their ideal of a state constitution and now had no notion of enduring the actuality. This great burning of the books was nothing but the destruction of one part of the political-philosophical literature and the abolition of propaganda and secret organizations. So the exact same thing played out in Chinese civilization, where eventually when their Caesar arrived, they then turned on what was left of the Confucians to the degree where they'll just burn all of the books. This defensive lasted in both imperia for a century, and then even reminiscences of party political passions faded out and the two philosophies became the ruling world outlook of the imperial age in its maturity. But the world was now the theatre of tragic family histories, into which state histories were dissolved. The Julian Claudian house destroyed Roman history, and the house of Shi Huang Ti, even from 206 BC, destroyed Chinese, and we darkly discern something of the same kind in the destinies of the Egyptian queen and her brothers. It is the last step to the definitive. With world peace, the peace of high policies, the sword side, the aggressive side, of being retreats, and the spindle side rules again. Henceforth, there are only private histories, private destinies, private ambitions, from top to bottom, from the miserable troubles of Fellaheen to the dreary feuds of Caesars for the private possession of the world. The wars of the Age of Peace are private wars, more fearful than any state wars because they are formless. So really it was the ideologies and again the merchant classes, the guilds, who were pulling the strings behind the wars between the nations. And because they've been now purged, according to Spengler, and at some future date in the Caesar's period of the civilizational cycle, they get wiped out, and what you get is the strong man coming in and laying down the law. But there's still no peace, because what you will then end up with is just sort of self-aggrandizement and the big character. There's going to be other big Caesar characters on stage and they're going to war against each other. And against this, the normal people just get trampled underfoot, which is what Spengler's going to... But the underall yearning is actually for world peace. And Spengler says, for world peace, which has often existed, in fact, involves the private renunciation of war on the part of the immense majority. But along with this, it involves an unavowed readiness to submit to being the booty of others who do not renounce it. I mean, this is great. So what does this say about liberalism in general, to be honest? This world liberalism is... It's very dangerous. It begins with the state-destroying wish for universal reconciliation, and it ends in nobody's moving a finger so long as misfortune only touches his neighbour. So everybody's retreating in just for themselves in their local areas. Already under Marcus Aurelius, each city and each land patch was thinking of itself, and the activities of the ruler were his private affair as other men's were theirs. The remoter people were as indifferent to him and his troops and his aims as they were to the projects of Germanic war bands. On this spiritual premise, a second Vikingism develops. The state of being, in form, passes from nations to bands and retinues of adventurers. Self-styled Caesars, seceding generals, barbarian kings, and whatnot, in whose eyes the population become in the end merely a part of the landscape. So you have these not so much nations, but factions at war with each other. And the actual population have just become this, they are now outside of history and they're returning back to the land in the way that they came. This is a deep relation. There is a deep relation between the heroes of the Mycenaean primitive age and the soldier emperors of Rome, and between, say, Menes and Ramses II. In our Germanic world, the spirits of Alaric and Theodoric will come again. There is a first hint of them in Cecil Rhodes, and this is a good bit. And the alien executioners of the Russian preface from Genghis Khan to Trotsky are, when all is said and done, very little different from most of the pretenders of the Latin American republics whose private struggles have long since put an end to the form-rich age of the Spanish Baroque. It's interesting that he brings up these republics from South America, because that's actually what it is. If you look at these republics in South America, can you say, are they really that like ideological? Do they have these deeply held liberal beliefs? Or any other kind of beliefs? Do the population, what does the general population of Peru, what is their political outlook? Look, in actual fact, they don't really have one. And this is where, so Spengler's saying, this is like what a late civilization looks like. It's where the people are just sort of outside of history, they're no longer engaged in politics, they don't have any deeply held beliefs. Everybody's retreating back into their own circle and just going back to the land. There's a problem with this for Faustian culture, which is another story, which Spengler gets into in Man and Technics. But basically, it's that our technology spans the whole planet. But that's for another time. With the form state, high history also lays itself down weary to sleep. Man becomes a plant again, adhering to the soil, dumb and enduring. The timeless village and the eternal peasant reappear, begetting children and burying seed in Mother Earth, a busy, not inadequate swarm over which the tempest of soldier emperors passingly blows. In the midst of the land lie the old world cities, empty receptacles of an extinguished soul, in which a historyless mankind slowly nests itself. So he's conjuring a picture here where all of the great mega cities of the West built on capitalism, they're all now just laying dormant. All of the great arenas are empty and people are using them to like feed their goats and stuff. It's over. They've gone back to the land. I did have a warning at the start of the video about black pills. So, but there's good news, because the fertility rate goes back up. Men are just going back to a more past. We're going outside of history, in the same way that actually most of the world is, in an ideological way. So then, men live from hand to mouth, with petty thrifts and petty fortunes, and endure. Masses are trampled on in the conflicts of the conquerors who contend for the power and the soil of this world, but the survivors fill up the gaps with a primitive fertility and suffer on. And while in high places there is eternal alternance of victory and defeat, those in the depths pray with what that mighty piety of the second religiousness that has overcome all doubts forever. So the second religiousness is what comes after the age of the Caesars and is the final end of the cycle of the civilization, where the grand politics, the grand international conflicts have been come to an end, and the people just go back to their soil go back to a more primitive existence, because it's all of these great forms have worn down and decayed and become decrepit. Capitalism as well, by the looks of it. And so what you end up with is people just going back to the land. And at least we've got high fertility rates again. And what you get then is the second religious phase. And so Spengler says, there in the souls, world peace, the peace of God, the peace of grey-haired monks and hermits, it's become actual, and there alone, it has awakened that depth in the endurance of suffering which the historical man, in the thousands of years of his development, has never known. Only with the end of grand history does holy, still being reappear. It is a drama noble in its aimlessness, noble and aimless as the course of the stars, the rotation of the earth, and the alternates of land and sea, of ice and virgin forest upon its face. We may marvel at it, or we may lament it, but it is there. And so that's how Spengler sums up the age of the Caesars, and I think I'll leave that there. Thanks for listening, folks, and I'll catch you later.